have so many things I want to do for you. I have so many things saved up to say. I have so many longings that belong to you. So Lord, don't turn away.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, July 24th, 2011. It is hot out there. My name is James Marino, and on the call this morning, we have Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia. Peter can be found three times a week at theatermania.com. Also writes for Masterworks Broadway on Tuesdays and for the Newark Star Ledger at all other times during the week. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hello. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a writer and photographer. You can see his writing and photography at BroadwayStars.com. You can see his writing at NPR.org and his photography at FollowSpotPhoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
How is everybody? You staying out of the heat?
Yeah.
You know, I swear this is true. I was driving the other day, and as I was driving under an underpass, I did look on my dashboard where it tells you how hot it is, and I swear that while I was under that underpass, it actually said 110. I was 110 in the shade. I really was. Honestly, I don't expect anybody to believe it. It's true, though.
Peter, you'll appreciate this. I have a friend in Boston. He said it was 102 the other day. And I think he said that the record for all of history in Boston is 104. So they almost got to that.
Yeah, I remember those 104 days way back when. But anyway, the worst is over for at least a few days, so we'll see what happens.
110 in the shade is quite apt, but I'd like to share with you this Neil Simon quote to see if you all appreciate this. Neil Simon moved to Los Angeles about 15 years ago, then moved back after 1 year. When he was asked the difference between the two, he asked, "When it's 32 degrees in New York, it's 78 degrees in Los Angeles. When it's 102 degrees in New York, it's 78 degrees in Los Angeles." There are about 2 million interesting people in New York and 78 in Los Angeles. So I know that we have a handful of Los Angeles listeners. Obviously, we don't mean you, and you are included in the 78 interesting people. All righty. We didn't have a lot of openings this week, and so we're going to talk mostly about the news. Unfortunately, we have the news that Tom Eldridge passed away. Michael, you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, well, Tom Eldridge was a wonderful actor. Who was born in 1928. And a lot of people who are listening here, I'm sure, know him most for his work as the narrator / mysterious man in Into the Woods, the original Broadway cast. And he was also in another Sondheim musical, Passion, which it was an interesting career for many reasons, but one of the things mainly is that he was not mainly a musical theater actor, and yet those are two of his most famous roles. And I'll never forget, I did a production of Where's Charlie when I was in high school. As I mentioned before, we had this very progressive nun who put together the shows at this girls' high school where we would go to do. They would import the boys from the local Catholic boys' high schools. And she would do unusual things. And that was one of them, because Where's Charlie, certainly back then, was almost never done. And it just so happened that, now I can't remember exactly the timing, but it was right after, I think, we did it, that it was announced that it was coming back to Broadway at the Circle in the Square with Raul Julia in the lead. And so we all went to see it, and Tom Aldridge played Spedigue, which was the role that I played in the high school production. And it was, so the first time I saw him, it was in a role that I had just played. So that was a lot of fun. He really was wonderful. And so a great range in terms of comedies and dramas. he was the original Norman Thayer in On Golden Pond. That's a kind of historically significant role that he had among many. I also read recently that he was a replacement for Cliff Gorman in The Boys in the Band. So that's an indication of his range. And also he was married for many since 1953 until her death in January of this year to Theonie V. Aldridge, the great costume designer for stage and screen. So now they're both gone, and it's a great loss to the theater and films and television as well.
Peter, what did you can you say about Tom?
I met him in 2004. He was down at the George Street Playhouse in New Brunswick, New Jersey, when he was doing Arthur Lawrence's play called Two Lives. What was interesting about that Boys in the Band, he did it in London as well, and he told me that Princess Margaret adored it and actually reserved a row and used to bring people once a week. Every week she would come to see it, which is quite – one wouldn't think necessarily that Princess Margaret would be that interested in The Boys in the Band, but she apparently was. He also was in Rex. Rex was the 1974 Rodgers and Harnick musical about Henry VIII. And I remember his saying that he was – he still seemed shell-shocked when he remembered the day that management gave him a new song and said, it's going to be put in the following performance. and he still seemed like he couldn't get over it. But what was also intoxicating was the fact that he actually did the song for me right then and there. While he was worried that he couldn't memorize it, he certainly memorized it enough so that he could do it for me at that day. However, he thought it was a terrible song. It didn't sound so good, but of course I was hearing it a cappella. He said they cut it after one performance, and he was very glad that that had happened. He also told me a fascinating fact about Into the Woods, which was that originally the narrator was supposed to have been the baby of the baker and his wife and was telling his life story. So,
right.
So that was kind of interesting. And also, when I asked him who his favorite co-star was, he said Elizabeth Taylor in The Little Foxes, which was surprising because that was a pretty reviled production that was done back in, I think, 81. He played Horace, her husband, the one that she hates and wants to see dead. So he said, I'm telling you, I will not allow anybody to say a bad word about her. She was delightful. She was hardworking, she was generous, and he said, because I played Horace, I always say that I was one of Liz Taylor's husbands, you know, I mean, which is funny, you know, because she had so many. He also told me about doing a play by Tennessee Williams, Vieux Carré, which got a recent revival in the last couple of years. He said that at one point he was saying a line and he like said a harumph or cleared his throat or something. And actually Tennessee Williams came right up to him afterwards and said, don't do that. And he said, you know, he was right. I was really interrupting the meter of the line, you know? So he was also very glad. He told me that he never became a star in the sense that people would recognize him. When he did On Golden Pond, he was 49 years old, which is really fascinating, given the fact, of course, the character is supposed to be so much older. And he said he used to have to wear this certain hairpiece, and he loved the fact that when he came out the stage door and people were waiting to meet Norman Thayer, he said, sometimes I just stand out there with them, you know, and, you know, like waiting for somebody myself, you know. And I used to get such a kick out of the fact that nobody knew that I was the guy they had just seen on stage. He said, I really wouldn't have wanted to be a star. Michael, that was interesting that you told that they were married, he and Theonie, from 53. Is that what you said?
That's what I'm reading here, yeah.
Wow.
You know, I mean, I knew it was for years, but I didn't know it was that long.
Oh, yeah, but I'll tell you what my inference was. And again, this shows how you can go wrong by making inferences. If you look at the original cast album of The Nervous Set, the 1959 musical that ran 12 performances, you see Tom Aldridge was in the show. fine. But you also see that the costumes were designed by Theoni and some Greek name beginning with a V. So it's she. You know, I mean, it's that Theoni. How many Theoni with a Greek name with a V can you find? You know, so I always assumed they met on the Nervous Set. You know, I mean, because there's her maiden name, and there's Tom Aldridge, and you know, love blossomed during the 12th performance run. But actually, I do recall asking him about this and saying, "Hey, you met in the Nervous Set?" He said, "No, many years before." So I never quite found out the year. So thank you for telling me the year. But what a wonderful thing to have a marriage that lasts all that long. It's really great, and you know, two very important building blocks in the American theater.
Yeah, I'm looking up her original name now, and I'm going to slaughter it. But
yeah,
let's see, Theoni Athanasiou Vakliotti.
Yeah.
She was born in Greece in Thessaloniki in 1922.
Yeah. So, but it was her maiden name that she used on the Take Out Your Cast album of the Nervous Set. I know you have it, Michael, and you will see that you will find the maiden name right then and there.
Yeah, it's such a storybook marriage that they were married for so long. That's great, and it's so sad that they're both gone.
It is good to note that both of Tom Aldridge's performances in Into the Woods and Passion were both preserved on commercial on videotape that are now available as commercial DVDs,
yeah.
Which a lot of actors can't say. Since he was not that active in film, it's good to have those preserved for people to see.
All right. So next on our agenda here for this morning is that all eyes are looking towards who is going to replace Mr. Radcliffe and how to succeed. So Darren Criss from Glee is rumored to be taking over for Mr. Radcliffe. So Michael, what do we know about Darren Criss?
Well, I don't know as much as a lot of other people do. I've seen clips of his performance on the show, and I guess he made a tremendous splash when he first appeared and wound up being a character who became, I guess, involved with the Chris Colfer character. Isn't that right? I think so. The thing about this is, I mean, he certainly seems very charming, very good looking, and has a really nice voice from what we can tell from seeing him on TV. I just don't understand, and maybe Peter, if you can help me, how this could possibly be true, because they're saying that his stint in How to Succeed would be limited to 3 weeks. And, you know, knowing how much it costs to rehearse someone into a show and then advertise their appearance in the show, it just does not make any sense for financially for that to do that for a 3-week run. And one would say, well, you know, if he's a big success, he'll extend. But the thing is, I don't think that's possible because of his commitments to Glee. So I don't know. I don't get that.
It doesn't seem like a 3-week run would make any sense whatsoever. You know, even if the production brought in, you know, cleared $1 million a week.
Yeah, I mean, assuming even that it absolutely sold out at the highest ticket price possible, it's still only 3 weeks. So I don't know.
Yeah. Peter, what were you going to say?
I assumed it was a misprint. They meant 3 months, which even then is not so long a period of time, and it wouldn't seem to be worth it. I understand the cachet of having someone from Glee on Broadway. What I found interesting is that he's played Harry Potter in some, as it says online here, a fan-made hit musical called A Very Potter Musical and A Very Potter Sequel. So I imagine something's going to be made of that as well, that we have another Harry Potter playing Pierpont Finch. So if he brings in people who are interested, fine. A friend of mine Mark Grossberg went to see How to Succeed recently during the weekend that the new Harry Potter movie opened, and he said it was really ratcheted up a notch having it happen right then and there. That people were much more excited than he would have expected them to be, just because in a strange way they were having that experience simultaneously to this big movie opening. So I think it is going to be tough to have a Daniel Radcliffe followed. And one would have expected that they would try to get a name that may be bigger than this guy, but, you know, Glee keeps on growing, so maybe it'll be fine.
I was trying to think, actually, if there had been a case before where there was a star that big of that big a movie on Broadway at the time of the movie's release. Maybe Hugh Jackman for one of the X-Men?
The one that comes to mind to me, and you know me, I always go back in time and seem quite content to live there much of the time too. But when Audrey Hepburn was doing Ondine, a play on Broadway, Roman Holiday was happening. So I know that there was a lot of consternation then. And that's even before my theater going time.
Oh,
that's
wow.
That's how far back that is, yeah. But I'm sure there are other examples. There was quite a difference between Albert Finney's Tom Jones and his Joe Egg. For a second, that came to mind, but there were many years between, actually. But it's a very good question, Michael. Who was white hot in film and theater at the same time, having properties open close to simultaneously?
The funny thing about How to Succeed is, well, another funny thing about it is that they had been mentioning Chris Colfer from Glee as possibly taking over for Radcliffe, and instead, apparently, it's going to be this guy who played his boyfriend on Glee. But the other interesting thing to me is 90% of the time, I think we've gotten used to people on Broadway and off-Broadway playing roles for which they're actually a few years too old, for a number of reasons. That happens a lot. But in this case, they seem to be consistently casting Finch with people who are really too young for it. He's not supposed to be, you know, just out of his teens.
Right. I agree.
And I think that actually is one of the negatives of the show with Radcliffe. And
yes,
I guess they keep trying to replicate that for, you know, for demographic reasons. So, so it's too bad that, you know, it's not a, I always said it was unfortunate that he couldn't have had a more age appropriate role, because I think it would have been better for everyone concerned.
Sure.
So anyway, we'll see. But the 3 weeks does not make sense to me. Maybe we'll learn more about it.
Well, we talk about like Fran and Barry's producing model for Chicago, and certainly they have people drop in for 3 weeks at a time. And so, you know, maybe they're looking at that model, and it's, you know, Chicago is more of a machine right now than than How to Succeed is, where you can drop somebody in for 3 weeks and rotate lots of stars in and out. They're talking, you know, Daniel Radcliffe's contract ends in January, and that's a terrible time for Broadway.
Right.
To bring somebody in for 3 weeks to get the sparks going, and then they've acknowledge that they're looking for somebody to take over yet again after Darren Criss is finished, and they're already starting that thing. So maybe it's more of a casting gimmick, and you know, they're not going to pay him tremendous amounts of money, but keep the show at least breaking even and keep it running so that they can keep the cast and crew and everything else intact and the theater intact.
Well, that would make sense. Yes, I was thinking if he's doing it more for the prestige and for the just the opportunity rather than the money. Chicago is your point is well taken, but it is different.
It's
not usually. There's no like major leading role like that where they and also they don't tend to publicize those people. I'll never forget how Jerry Springer came and went in the Broadway production without anyone I know being aware that he was even in it. So if they're going to get the bang for their buck. They're going to want to publicize it, but the publicity costs a lot of money. But yes, that would be the only thing that would make sense if they were putting him in just as just to spark it up, as you say, and then they. But that'll just make it even more difficult, I would think, to find someone then to take over after that. So we'll it's going to be interesting to see.
Hugh Jackman. He could keep that show running, I think.
That's right.
Well, as several people have pointed out, the perfect person would be Neil Patrick Harris.
Yeah.
But I that would be so wonderful if that would happen. I doubt it, but we'll see.
All righty. Talking about how to keep shows running, Patrick Healy wrote an article in the New York Times this week about the staggering cost of Broadway, where he talked and caused quite a commotion with a discussion with Sonia Friedman, who's a Broadway producer. Peter, you want to tell us a little bit about that?
So Sonia Friedman was talking about how Jerusalem won't recoup. She made a definite statement saying that. Now, again, this was quoted in the Times, the same newspaper that called Jerusalem a magnificent play, getting an enthralling production, and that Mark Rylance was giving a seismic performance. Brantley also said, "I can imagine no other contemporary actor doing as well." So, there it was. It was going to be the best play nominee. It didn't win because Warhorse was exciting. But really, Mark Rylance's performance should have been enough to make people say, well, if this really is one of the great performances, we have to go see it. So I can understand why she's discouraged. I have to say, too, that I wonder, I'm throwing this in, this may not even be quite on topic, but I'm wondering if, given the fact that the Tonys are now one of the premier marketing tools of Broadway, that people watch the Tonys, and there's no question that the day after the Tonys, some shows really benefit, the orders go up by phone and by internet. So is it possible that Jerusalem was tremendously harmed by Mark Rylance's acceptance speech, which wasn't the usual, I'd like to thank, I'm so excited. It was nothing like that at all. He quoted an obscure poem, and it's his way of commenting on, we shouldn't get so excited about awards. But given the fact that Jerusalem has often been presented to the public as a play that takes its roots in a hymn and a William Blake poem and all that kind of stuff, I wonder if people said, oh, I'm not going to understand it, and stayed away. I wonder about that.
Well, I don't know. That's an excellent point, Peter. But also, I mean, come on, guys. It's not exactly the most commercial thing in the world. I mean, isn't it almost 3 hours long?
It is.
Also, it's one of those things where the title tells you absolutely nothing about what you're going to get. It's kind of hard to explain. It's kind of hard to explain the play to someone in a concise sentence or two, because it's very complicated. It's not, although the first part of it is extremely funny, it's not ultimately a comedy. It's actually quite heavy and serious. What's the mystery here? I don't get it.
Oh, really? I just feel that Mark Rylance's performance should be enough to get people in the theater, given that everybody's going so crazy about it. So, because you don't hear a bad word about him. I will admit, I've heard very mixed reports on the play, which I enjoyed immeasurably.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, there are people do. I walk by that theater in the morning sometimes, and I see kids lined up for whatever it is, lottery or whatever line up for in the morning. So there are people who are going to support that. But I'm just talking about the mass numbers of. I mean, obviously, it's less commercial than How to Succeed or.
And I mean, plays don't do as well as musicals, of course,
right.
but nevertheless, I would think that given that so many critics went on out and said that this was one of the finest performances they'd seen, or a magnificent performance, you can't miss it, all that kind of stuff, the people wouldn't miss it. So I'm a little surprised that Jerusalem didn't do better than it did. But I have to say, you know, I just wonder if that Tony speech was a liability.
Well, especially since, as you said, since it's the reviews were so much around him, people were probably watching specifically. And if he had said something that had been understandable or entertaining to the general public, then that might have made a significant difference.
Well, the other thing too is there really is I don't find this a hard play to quote unquote understand. I mean, a lot of people are intimidated by the British stuff, you know, that takes place on St. George's Day. Quick, when's that? You know, I mean, not even in Jerusalem. It's in a place called Flintock, Wiltshire County. I mean, that's where it takes place. I mean, I will admit that all that, the metaphors about a crumbling England, you know, I mean, I do understand why all this will make people say, what else is playing? I mean, I do understand that. But I would have thought that Rylance's performance would have trumped all that and that people would have come. So I can understand why this lady is gun shy about bringing over another property to Broadway. Has there ever been a time when we haven't heard about costs spiraling out of control and all that? I forget who I was talking to recently, talking about reading it was Jason Zinnemann, right, was telling me about reading a book by Benedict Nightingale from the 80s, talking about, costs are just out of control now. What are we going to do? We cannot possibly ask people to pay more than $40 a ticket. I mean, it just cannot be done. This is as high as it can possibly go. And, I mean, now people are saying to me, hey, such and such is on TBF for $40, acting like it's the deal of the century. You know, so I guess, you know, theater is one of those things that's always retroactively going to be a bargain. But I don't think it's strange to have any producer tell us why costs are spiraling out of control and it just isn't worth doing anymore.
Well, and not to get heavily into it, but doesn't that article, it certainly delves into the unions to some extent, doesn't it?
Well, sure. The article, you know, it quotes Ms. Friedman as far as saying, you know, the cost of moving and mounting sets and equipment, the salaries for stagehand technicians, designers, and others to assemble the production, theater rents, marketing and advertising budgets, which usually include television commercials. I don't think that those things are in necessarily a highest to lowest order. You know, we're talking about, you know, marketing and advertising budgets that are really very, very expensive, and theater rent, which is very expensive. By time you get to salaries, you're talking about your weekly running costs, especially for a play. You know, you want to keep them in that $300,000 range. Whereas a single full page ad in the New York Times, you know, can wipe you out for six figures. So certainly
that's why people aren't doing them anymore.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it used to be that you get the spring preview of the New York Times on a Sunday and you would grab that and you'd have, you know, 12, 15 full page ads from Broadway Productions, and you saw what was coming that spring and you could see the beautiful ads and who was coming and who was going to be in it and all that stuff. And that doesn't happen anymore.
What also doesn't happen is that shows don't run an inordinately short period of time either. I did a column the other day about 1968 to 1970, let's say, and there were an inordinate number of shows that ran one night. Musicals, Billy, Blood Red Roses, Gantry, Here's Where I Belong, La Strada with Bernadette Peters, all ran one night. were they any better or worse than, let's say, forgive me, Frank Wilde, on Wonderland? I mean, Wonderland didn't run a long time, 33, I believe, but there would have been a time when it would have either closed on opening night or played its four performances, and that was it. But there seems to be much more money built in now to withstand bad reviews and to keep you going a longer period of time, so you don't have to throw in the towel immediately.
Well,
so
One of the reasons that many producers won't throw in the towel immediately is so that if the production runs a certain number of performances, the rights vest to the producer.
Indeed, but that was always true.
But so they're not going to close on opening night if they've lost, you know, $10 million when they can possibly take it out on the road.
No, all set there. I mean, but that has always been in effect. I think it's 23 performances you have to run for that to kick in. The figure may be wrong, but that's been true since I've been paying attention to the theater. And so why give up after one night under those circumstances? Keep it going so that you can get those extra rights. But no, I think it was just that there was there were several plays during that period of time, things nobody's ever heard of. Bright Tower, The Cuban Thing, Happiness is Just a Little Rolls Royce, The Mother Lover, A Place for Polly, and my personal favorite, A Teaspoon Every 4 Hours, which opened on June 14th, 1969. And I swear that last year on June 14th, when I noticed that, and Jackie Mason was a co-author of it, I thought, gee, it'd be fun to run to Jackie Mason today, which I occasionally do because he lives in my neighborhood. And wouldn't you know, there he was having a meal at an outdoor cafe. And I said, do you know, 41 years ago today, A Teaspoon Every 4 Hours? He looked like he'd been shot in the head. all these shows, you know, I mean, these were shows that closed after one night. You don't see that anymore. And I'm not saying I'm not getting nostalgic for the one night stands. I'm not. All I'm saying is that this is where some of the money goes now, that you build in this fund so that you don't have to close immediately.
Well, James brought up an interesting question to which I'm sure none of us has an answer, but have there been any decrease in advertising prices in venues like the New York Times over the past few years, given the sea change in just, you know, that is caused by the internet and
I will tell you that internet advertising prices have gone down dramatically. To advertise on the internet is much, much less expensive today than it was 5 and 10 years ago. Although you're reaching a much wider, vast audience. You're talking about what they in advertising parlance, you want to talk about how far your ad reaches. So if the New York Times on a Sunday, we'll just use round numbers here, these aren't accurate, would reach 1 million people, and you're paying, you know, $100,000 for your ad, your cost for the advertising, is 10 cents per ad impression, which is somebody looking at your ad. So that's what's called a cost per impression. And the cost per impression on the internet has dropped like a stone off of a building. In the last 10 years. So while we are reaching many, many more people on the internet, the cost for advertising has dramatically dropped. And a lot of shows are advertising on the internet rather than going to print for, you know, the national magazines, the Times and the Newsweeks. They're gone. They're all but closed.
Yeah, sure. And I don't blame people. What's also interesting to me, since you bring up that point, James, is the fact that We often remember that when VCRs first came out, they were in the $1,000 range, and then, of course, they were $69 after a few years. So in a strange way, the internet advertising has followed the technology of being expensive at first and not so expensive later.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, is the main reason for the drop within the internet field, is that because of there are so many more websites?
Well, it's a... from an economic perspective, there's discussion about whether it's competition from many, many sites. I mean, I run Broadway Stars, as you all know, and, you know, Robert runs Broadway World, and, and, you know, you have the other major sites like Broadway.com and Theater Mania and Playbill, and they all have very different models. People don't realize that the advertising model is, you know, in my opinion, and certainly this is not the gospel, but this is just my opinion, you know, Broadway.com's model on the internet is not advertising, it's selling tickets. Broadway.com makes most of their money from selling tickets in, for New York and London shows. Mm-hmm. Playbill makes most of their money from their print product that's in the theaters, and their advertising on their website is ancillary. You have Theater Mania, which does a lot of focus on the regional markets and does a lot of email blasts and various other support for smaller off-Broadway shows for ticketing and things like that. That's their main model. It's really not advertising. And then you have Broadway World, which is really a focus on advertising. And since Broadway World has come into the market as being a strong player, I mean, Broadway World's traffic is more than all the other websites combined. So Broadway.com, Playbill, Theater Mania can add up all their visitors every month, and they still don't reach the number of visitors that Broadway World gets. And since Broadway World is such a large player and Robert has such a huge amount of inventory of page impressions, that has really caused the advertising on Broadway to drop precipitously in price. If you're producing the next great thing here in New York, where are you going to advertise? You're going to advertise on the most popular Broadway website, which is offering lower and lower rates every day. Mm. So, this is not a discussion about advertising in the Broadway show, but it just, we went off on a slight tangent here to discuss the capitalization of shows and how certainly advertising on the internet for a Broadway show is only a very small part of their budget. You know, it probably won't even reach $50,000 a week if, you know, and you're talking about budgets that are in the tens of millions of dollars. So,
sure.
Well, so, as some of us remember, it wasn't that long ago, there was an attempt made to sort of work against all of this, although obviously things have changed even since then. But there was something called the Broadway Alliance, which attempted to sort of get cooperation from all of the various unions and parties and stuff in order to bring costs down precipitously. And I think it lasted a year or two.
And you know why? I really believe this in my soul. I think that they were charging about $30 when tickets were about $60. The figures may be wrong, but it was something like that. And my point is that when you tell people that you are offering them a show that's half price compared to all the other shows on Broadway, people automatically think it can't be very good, because if indeed it were good, it would be charging the higher price. And I think that's why that was defeated. Yes, indeed. I remember the Broadway Initiative very well. A play called Dancing in the End Zone, I think, was one of the first to do it. But it's a strange thing. You know, people need to be punished with high prices to think they're getting the best. It's so bizarre. So what has to happen is that a smash hit offers tickets at a lower price. And when's that going to happen? I mean, that Book of Mormon free performance was a miracle. But by and large, that isn't going to happen. The only time that shows start charging half price is when they can't get full price anymore. So
we've talked to a handful of folks on this podcast. Ken Davenport and Damien from Situation Interactive come to mind. And they both talk about very often about the need not to discount tickets because of just exactly what Peter's saying, is that and it's why Broadway hasn't really gone into the Groupon area, because Groupon is seeing the effect of where folks are saying, you know, that's what I want to pay for this product now. If I've gotten this price one time, why can't I get it all the time?
Mm.
And sometimes the numbers don't work.
Well, that is so interesting, but it seems like that has not become an issue in the theater. And if it hasn't yet, maybe it won't. But it's always, I always have such mixed feelings about this, as I've said. I mean, on the one hand, you know, we can all say how high costs are, how high ticket prices are. But on the other hand, we can always say it's supply and demand, and that they will only get it if people want it. And the minute that people don't want it at that price, they're going to have some way to get it to them at a lesser price. You know, but then there are other things that add into it, like the whole premium seats thing, and the fact that it's so very hard to get a ticket to to a hit in the first year or two. It used to be much easier to do that one way or another. And I guess that's largely because so many tickets are held back in the hope that they can be sold at premium prices or whatever. So that's another very large piece of the puzzle.
It's astonishing to me that when I get house seats for friends or relatives, you know, they used to be E, now they're L, you know, yeah. Because, again, those premium seats are definitely there. Another thing, when you go to London, I don't know if this is still true, but it certainly was true for a number of years. There's that marvelous brochure you get of Theatreland in London where they you open it up. It's like a road map. I'm talking about the size of it and listing all the shows and where they are and what times they're on. And The Mousetrap, which has been running since 1952. That is not a mistake. It has been running since 1952. All right. It always used to have on that piece of paper, sorry, no discounts anywhere. And again, I don't know if it's still true, but for a number of years, that was it. You want to see The Mousetrap, you're paying full price, and that's all there is to it. And it hasn't hurt its run, has it?
So, coincidentally, maybe, I'm not sure how this happened, but along with Patrick Healy's article in the New York Times, we have the ACT Theater out in Seattle made an announcement that they're sort of doing a type of Netflix type of subscription offer where you could see as much theater as produced, excuse me, at the ACT Theater in Seattle for $25 a month, which is an interesting, attempt at developing new audiences. So they have the main stage shows. They have what they call Central Heating Lab shows, which are smaller black box productions. They have a bunch of different things at their theater. That they have dance, they have music and film programs that you want, and all these are included for the $25 a month, and you do it all online, and it's interesting to see companies trying to kind of break this mold and get new people in. I wonder how it's going to do, but ACT came under a lot of pressure a number of years ago. They did an pay what you can type of thing a number of years ago, and then they also started raising prices, and now this is their new attempt, what's called an ACT Pass, excuse me, ACTPASS, and we'll link to it on the show notes page if you want to check it out, especially if you're in the Seattle area, and you know, let us know how it's working out. I don't know if I'd get out there this year to go see anything in Seattle, but certainly some of the listeners are out there, and we can, you know, take it from your mouth what's happening there. Also, what's happening is that coincidentally is that there seems to be some legislation heating up in Washington D.C. about what they call the secondary market on tickets, which we call scalping. And their organizations like Ticketmaster and StubHub and various other groups have formed nonprofit organizations to lobby Congress on their point of view of what should happen with ticket reselling. So, Michael, Peter, what's your opinion on ticket reselling?
Well, I'm going to tell a story that fascinated me back in the early 90s. A friend of mine was working at Telecharge. And they would be told at Telecharge, they only at Telecharge, we're going to have a new block of seats opening up for Phantom on June 9th at 10 o'clock in the morning. And my friend said it was astonishing how at 10 o'clock on the dot, people would call up and say, yes, I'd like 20 tickets for Phantom. That they just knew that was happening. So word was leaking out that indeed new tickets were going on sale. And these were clearly people who would plan to resell them later. I think that's why that ticket ban came on. You can't buy more than so many tickets at a certain time. But it's always going to be with us. There's no way around it. I have no feeling that scalping should remotely exist. Some people even strangely, it's probably the same feeling that people get from masochism. I mean, I think people just like to be punished and they're willing to pay the high price. So scalping will always be with us, you know, whip me with your high price. I mean, it's amazing to me, but again, as Michael says, supply and demand, you know, I mean, what can you do? I don't think there's any way around it. In a strange way, I'm reminded of the play Quills, which tells about you can do what you can to stop people's sexuality. You can lock them up. You can cut off their hands. They will always find a way to be sexual. I think people will always find a way to buy tickets at high prices, and there will be people who will sell them to them. It has always been in effect, and no matter what legislation will happen, I think there are going to be people calling up telecharge and getting those tickets that other people should be getting, and that's going to be it.
Michael, what do you think?
Well, I don't have much to add because I too have, you know, similar feelings, and I don't know what to say about it. But I do wonder if it is it better, quote unquote, if the scalping at least is being done like sort of in a regulated way rather than, you know, some guy standing on the corner, you know, on 44th Street and saying, "Hey, I've got, you know, two for whatever, the Addams Family, you know."
Yes.
You know, maybe but, at least it's a little more, you know, a little more.
But that's how the premium seating started with the producers when they were asking, what was it, $4.20 a seat? I mean, so in other words, all that's happened is that the producers started scalping because that's what premium seats are. That's scalping. It really is.
Right. So I'm saying, is that better? You know, I mean, at least in the sense of that it's, you know, I mean, it's a little more above board, you know, whether that makes any difference. And it's a little more definite and in, you know, it's written down.
Well, there are people who say, you know, I'd rather give it to the theaters themselves,
right.
Or at least
yeah.
That way I know the actors benefit, you know, so on and so forth. I don't know. I guess there's something to be said for the little guy in the street corner selling those two tickets. He might need the money substantially more than these fat cats. I mean, I don't know, you know.
I know. Well, play devil's advocate. Why not? You should.
Well you know, I want to, you know, a lot of people don't realize that there are so many ways to get premium seats for shows that don't really have premium seating. You know, if in fact you have somebody coming into town that has to absolutely see Wicked, you know, and I don't know if Wicked offers premium seats through the box office or whatever, but if you have to see a certain production of performance of Wicked, and you call the Actors Fund or you call Broadway Cares, you can buy premium seats from the Actors Fund and Broadway Cares and get a tax deduction. So basically if the tickets are $100, they will charge you $200, which is actually still cheaper than most brokers and most scalpers. And then you'll get $100 tax deduction because it's a donation to the Actors Fund or Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS. And so a lot of people don't realize that. And that's one way of putting the money into more beneficial hands if that's your moral objection to dealing with scalpers. The other aspect of it is attacking it from the supply side. We're talking about supply and demand. Increase the supply. And how do you increase the supply? Well, when's the last time we built a new Broadway theater? You know? If the Broadway League is serious about attacking these things, take a look at the supply side. I mean, we have Nederlanders, Drew Jamsons, and Schuberts, and various other very wealthy people, Scott Rudin, that could, in fact, build a new Broadway theater if, in fact, they wanted to do it. I guess,
I'll buy back the Hellinger.
Yeah, buy back the Hellinger. I don't know if we, in fact, would consider what happened with the New Amsterdam, you know, opening it again for Broadway productions. And I guess some of the Roundabout stuff and various other producing organizations. So increase the supply and then address it from, okay, we have Book of Mormon that is, you cannot get a ticket to it. It's showing 8 times a week. Why not show 10 times a week, 12 times a week? And certainly you're going to kill the cast doing that. So why not have two casts?
When was the there was that Greece, was it Greece? Greece was playing at two different theaters.
Yeah, two theaters, Touring company came by, right. Yeah.
And then there was a more recent case of where it was discussed or something, I don't remember how. Anyway, it obviously
42nd Street talked about it. David Merrick talked about doing it with 42nd Street, which may have just been a way to publicize that 42nd Street was hot. I mean, knowing David Merrick, he might have had no intentions of doing that, but just knew he'd get the show in the news if he said that he was thinking of doing it. Of course, and the obvious problem to that is somebody who says, I want to see the A cast, not the B cast.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, that happens with Billy Elliot right now and various other types of things. You don't know which Billy is going to be on, and you have matinee Phantoms and matinee Christines and it happens in almost every show. It's just that it's more known to the insiders than it is to the consumers who are out there buying their tickets 4 months in advance because they're going to visit New York.
Well, another thing that was great that you mentioned that, James, about buying through Broadway Cares. There's also the Actors Fund performances, although they don't happen very often.
Yeah.
But that's another. And another thing, in case people don't know, if you want to plan ahead to see a show that's hot, there's very little options, very few options you have to get a good ticket or a discount or even something other than a premium price. But if you are able to be flexible and you want to see the latest hot thing, and if you try right before you're going to go, you have a fairly good chance that you might get a ticket that was either a premium ticket that was unsold and was being held, or maybe a house seat that was not purchased. So that is something to keep in mind if you're local, or if you're visiting here and you're just willing to be very flexible and just take your chances.
Yeah, generally house seats are released 48 hours before the performance.
Right.
So if at 48 hours before the performance, you go to the box office, you're not going to find these at TDF. You're not going to find them at the TKTS booth or anything like that. They're only going to be at the box office. So you'll pay full price for it, but you'll get an excellent seat. And these are insider things that people, know that they hold a house seat. And if it goes unsold 48 hours before, then they'll put it on sale for general. And that's why people queue up in front of Book of Mormon and things like that, hoping that the house seat doesn't get sold and they'll be able to buy it.
It's so interesting because of the various methods. It's quite possible for a person in a theater to be sitting next to someone who paid, three times as much.
Like an airplane.
Yeah, exactly. Because that's exactly, I think that's been mentioned as a sort of a model for the new way that it's the more recent way that it's being done over the past couple of decades.
All right, so I want to start wrapping up here, but before we wrap up, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to BroadwayStars.com, and on the right hand side there's a Broadway Radio logo. Right below that logo there's a subscribe button. That way each and every time a new episode of Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway comes out, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes. Some of you out there are not interested in listening to it in iTunes. You can get it in many other ways. You can get it through the Zune Marketplace. You can listen to it on Google's Listen application on Android. On a BlackBerry, iPhone, or Android device, you can go to Stitcher, STITCHER. It's an application where you can stream these podcasts. Or you can listen to us on Broadway World Radio three times a week, Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7, and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Also, if you want to get in touch with us, you can go to BroadwayRadio.com, and Peter, Michael, and my contact info is right there. Phone numbers, email address, Twitter accounts, Facebook accounts, any way to reach us, they're all right there. And so you can give us feedback as far as anything that we say here. We're getting a lot of really great feedback in the last couple of weeks. Also want to let you know that I did get a handful of folks who want to listen to us live, and we're going to put that together and try to make that happen before the end of the summer, and we'll see how that goes. But last week we talked about the New Jersey Youth Theater's production of Kiss Me, Kate, and Peter had seen it, but Michael hadn't. Michael went this week. Michael, tell us about it.
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to follow up because I really loved it, as Peter did. also, I think we had misstated that it actually went through today is the final. Well, today when we're recording was Sunday the 24th, and yeah, it's a really fantastic production. As Peter said, the young woman who played Lily Kate, Elise Langley, she really, I kind of felt she could just step into a professional production at any moment. Also the same for Fred Graham Petruchio, although, I mean, he looked a little younger. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in a couple of years, I think he'll be able to step into a professional production. But they were just terrific together, their professionalism and their expertise. And I'm going to pay this production the best compliment I can, because it's funny, Peter, it never occurred to me, stupidly, that this would be the revised version of the show.
Oh.
Yeah. For some strange reason, that never entered my mind. And I really don't like that revised version.
Sure.
So I got there, and as soon as I realized it, you know, there was no overture, mm-hmm. and it started with that really silly rearrangement of another open and another show, and I was really upset, and I brought a friend who had not seen, I guess he had not seen the revised version, and so he was disappointed too, and to the point where, like, I, for the first couple of scenes, I thought, well, you know, maybe we can leave it intermission, but the kids were so great, and the production was so well directed, and the orchestra sounded so fantastic that by the end of the first act, I was like, I'm not leaving, I'm going to stay, and I'm glad I did. So I think that's a great compliment to play. I felt that they were actually working against the really, really unwise revisions that were made, including this silly way that they put in from this moment on in Act Two, just really silly.
May I point out, Cynthia Merrill, who runs the organization, told me, this is it. You want to do Kiss Me, Kate. This is all you can do now is this version. You cannot do the original version. And that's really sad.
Well, yeah. That's sad. I should hasten to say I only saw the original version once that I can remember, and it actually is not perfect either. There's a lot of book to it, and the show originally, I think, can be a full 3 hours. This was a little bit less. Mm-hmm. So it's not as if it was absolutely perfect and then they ruined it, but I do think that a lot of the decisions that they made were for the worst. And that scary. That's a whole other podcast, you know, where you cannot do the original version.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like rewriting history, you know, that's not good.
I will say this, Michael, about Kiss Me, Kate. It is famous for being a show that went out of town and changed nothing. Peter Stone used to like to say they didn't even change a comma. but it probably was the only show to go out and come in virtually frozen from its Philadelphia opening. So at that time, at least, they thought it was pretty good. So, but now you can't do that version. So what are you going to do?
Well, you know, I guess the positive thing that came out of it is that the performances were great, and hopefully we're going to see more of these, more of the actors that are with this company come directly to Broadway. And
as I mentioned last week, the young man, Michael Rodriguez, who played Angel in Rent there last summer, is playing it now in New York. So that's a pretty good criterion.
Yeah. So, you know, from, you know, sort of like Broadway's minor league team.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a minor league baseball team in Newark. So I guess there's another one.
All right, I want to wrap up. We're going to talk about, I went to see Cirque du Soleil's Zarkana at Radio City Music Hall, and Michael and Peter have not seen it, but there's really not much to say about it other than if you are a fan of Cirque, which I am a fan of Cirque, and I've seen a bunch of their other shows, this is something to see. I'm not sure that it needed to displace the Tony Awards. It certainly the Tonys could have managed on the Cirque stage.
Well, I was wondering about that, James. What do you think that's... I mean, because there's normally... maybe it has something to do with the specific requirements of things, you know, technical stuff that has to be there for Cirque.
Well, you know, certainly if they're able to do it, if they're able to do a Tony Awards on other Broadway stages, as has happened in the past, on
and
taken over that, they could have certainly taken over Cirque in some way. I'm not sure if Cirque said no, or the Tony Awards said no, or Radio City said no, or whatever. But you know, there is a lot of build on the stage, so it's not as though it was a blank stage. You know, Cirque du Soleil productions certainly will match any Julie Taymor production, and in fact, I don't know why Julie just doesn't go work there.
I have been told, by the way, this doesn't make it true, but I have been told that actually Cirque's commitment to Radio City is 5 years.
Yes, yes, I've been told the same thing.
So as a result, you know, the Tonys will go scrambling again for the next four. Although
no, I'm told, but yeah, it seems like everyone was
thrilled that it wasn't a Radio City, except those people who couldn't get into it. The fans who like to be at the Tonys, and I understand that point of view entirely. But in terms of the show itself, people, more than one person, more than 400 people have said to me, you know, I liked it at the Beacon. It was more intimate, you know. So
well,
something you said for that.
I have to say that if it's at the Beacon again, I will not be covering it from a journalist standpoint. There's no way I'm going back to, you know, it was poorly, poorly run and kind of a disaster. And they just don't have the facilities to handle the media. And so unless I buy a ticket and I'm sitting in the audience, I'm watching it at home.
And apparently I'm told that... you know, I don't have 100% confirmation, but I'm told that the orchestra was in a separate building.
Really?
Yeah, like in the 20s somewhere, you know, like blocks and blocks away. Which, and I mean, if even if they were across the street, they might as well be a mile away.
Sure,
but that does sort of, if that's true, that does sort of add to the, the feeling.
Canned music.
That's interesting. I know, but anyway, back to Zarkana is that you can't take away the talent of the performers on the stage are just unbelievably amazing, and that's a feat to see within itself. They build this as a rock opera. It's neither an opera nor is it theater. It's a spectacle and it's interesting. And there's a lot of talent on the stage. I thought the story is terrible and disjointed, and it just call it what it is. And it's a spectacle of you know, physicality that is amazing. But you know, insofar as it being a book show or an opera, I think that is that's not being true to
whenever
your marketing.
Whenever I've gone to a Cirque show and afterwards I read the synopsis, I'm stunned that's
what
the show is about. You know, really? You know, who knew?
Yeah, actually, so, that was my question. Did you feel that compared to other Cirque shows, James, did you feel that it was more disjointed and you did? Okay.
Yeah, I didn't see that banana spiel up at the Beacon
last year.
I didn't see that, but I saw the Beatles one out in Vegas. I saw O out in Vegas and a few others here and there. And I really enjoyed them, but this certainly had much, much less connection to a story and a book. But one of the things that I kept on thinking about, which wasn't happening on stage, but was happening in Radio City, was I was sitting in $200 plus seats, and the family sitting next to me was a family of four, a father, a mother, and two kids, and they might as well have been sitting at home in their living room, because they had full-throated conversations throughout the entire thing. We're going up and down the aisles, bringing food back into Radio City, which traditionally doesn't happen at Broadway shows, that they don't bring food. I guess Rock of Ages, they bring drinks into the aisle or something. But it was a back and forth and full-throated conversations and no respect for anybody around them. And if this is the development of audiences that they're trying to bring to Broadway shows, you know, maybe it's almost that we want to keep under the radar. I don't. What do you guys? What do you do in this circumstance? I mean, Matthew Murray and I saw that Gold Rush or whatever, that disaster, the Stephen Sondheim show at the Kennedy Center 5 years or so ago. And was it Gold Bounce. Rush or Gold Bounce. Or yeah. Bounce?
Bounce. Bounce. Gold was the title. Yeah. Gold was the title for a while, but Bounce was the title. Bounce. Was there.
When we saw, and we had this person in back of us that was just talking and being rude during the whole performance, and we turned around and yelled at them, and the ushers came down and took care of them, and other people did this. But at Radio City, at Zarkana, you know, there was nothing. There was nothing anybody else did around us. So what do you guys deal with that?
Well, for one thing, people make a lot of criticism of critics and how terrible we all are and how mean we all are, but at least we behave in the theater. So many times, you know, when I go to a performance, I'm at a critics performance and we're all very well behaved. Sometimes somebody from New Jersey will go into a show and I'll do a feature a year or two later, and that's when I'm shocked at
yes.
the behavior of John Q. theatergoer and how they do that. What I've taken to doing and is looking at them, I go to my cell phone, I pretend I'm making a phone call, I describe the person, I say, okay, the person has red hair, he's wearing a red jacket, take care of him, and then I just and they shut up. They're really petrified, and that does the trick.
You're making Italians from Boston look bad, Peter.
Exactly. I'm using my Italian looks. I have to use them. You know, I mean, I'm certainly old enough to look like I could be a major player, you know, who has worked his way up and has been made and all the rest of it. But I'm telling you, let the punishment fit the crime. You know, so.
It's a problem because a lot of people just will not speak up. I'll never forget. I was in a situation. I don't remember what the show was or whatever, but somebody had a plastic bag on his lap, you know, and just kept crinkling it throughout the show. And it wasn't, if I remember, it wasn't a loud musical, so you could really hear it. So after a few minutes of that, I turned around and I said, you know, can you please put your bag on the floor? And the person did, you know. And then afterward, like at intermission, somebody else seated near us came to me and said, "You're my hero." And I'm like, well, gosh, you know, all I did was ask him to.
There are some people who have these nervous habits. I mean, I've been next to people who like to flip the playbill pages, you know, just over and over. You know, it's a nervous habit. They don't. It's time passing. I guess it's a way of indicating they don't like the show very much. But the nervous habits, which again are not malicious, you have to watch out for them too. Because the tapping foot. I don't mean with music. I just mean you know, the tapping foot out of nervousness. There's a lot of that going on.
But then there are just people who really just don't know how to behave because they haven't been in that situation, and they also don't seem to want to learn. Or they think in their mind that it's equivalent to going to see a movie. I've told this story also. I went to see I think it might have been Rock of Ages, but anyway, it doesn't matter what it was. At some point, this woman, like in the second row center, got up in the middle of Act One and disturbed everyone to her left to get out, to go somewhere. And then, you know, 10 minutes later, she came back and disturbed them all again to go back and take her seat in the middle of the second row. And I saw her as she was leaving. It didn't seem like she was ill. It didn't seem like she had any kind of an emergency. I think she just went to the ladies' room or went to go have a smoke or maybe make a cell phone call. And I thought, gosh, you know, that's just not acceptable. But it is happening more often now because people just don't know or don't care.
Well, I, you know, haven't thought about this in years and years and years. And perhaps you can tell me how many years it is, Peter. But when Cyrano the musical was being played on Broadway with
Christopher Plummer,
the Dutch one.
Oh, the other one, yeah,
Dutch one, the Joop van Ent one. I guess it was in the 90s sometime. I had gotten tickets to it, and we were like second, third, fourth row center or something like this, and I was sitting next to a gentleman who had like a Foster's can of beer. Have you seen the Foster's? Or they're, it's like,
oh yeah, yeah,
gallon really of beer, big, something right, like right. that.
right.
He had got it past the usher somehow, and drank it, and then after the show started, started to sing along with music he didn't
yeah.
know. Like, he was so moved by this show. And I just remember thinking, wow, you know, I couldn't tell you anything about the Cyrano the Musical, because all I could do was think about this guy next to me. I have no idea what happened in that show, because this guy next to me, and certainly was much, much bigger than I. And so that also determines on whether I'm going to say something or not, especially to somebody who's been drinking. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, speaking of drinking in the theater, there's going to be a big party today. Well, I think today.
Oh, yeah.
Tomorrow. Right. Audra McDonald is singing at New York State's First Gay Marriage, and that's not going to be in a theater that I know of, but they're having a bunch of marriages at the St. James tomorrow, I think it is, with where Hair is playing. Is Hair playing at St. James?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right.
And they're having a bunch of some of the first marriages in New York State of gay marriages. And it's something very interesting, because you don't often think of the institution of Broadway. Certainly a lot of the Broadway performers and people involved are very politically active, but now you think of you know, Jew Jamson doing all these events, which has been driven by Jordan Roth, who's the president, the new president of Jew Jamson. He's been president for a few years, and being involved with a big political thing like this. And I wonder how it affects, if it affects any ticket sales, or makes people uncomfortable, or not so much the gay marriage thing, but uncomfortable from a standpoint of a business becoming very political. And we'll have to see what happens there. Michael, you going to say something?
No, I mean, that's an interesting question. You know, a Hair, in a sense, is the perfect show for it, for obvious mm-hmm. reasons. You know, just the whole hippie, you know, love, not war kind of thing. And Gavin Creel, who was in Hair originally, was is one of the founders of Broadway Impact, which is the organizations that has worked towards gay marriage and against Prop 8. And Rory O'Malley, who's giving a great performance in the Book of Mormon, is another one who's very active in it. So they made an announcement. They had a press conference last week or 2 weeks ago in front of the St. James about this. And by the way, one of the couples getting married is Terry White, and her partner, whose name I don't remember, I'm sorry, Terry White, who many of you may know for her performance in Finian's Rainbow.
And that also, very stage.
Yes, and she'll also be back very soon in Follies, because she did it at the Kennedy Center, and she'll be doing the Broadway transfer. So that's I think that's maybe the most high-profile couple, in a sense, that will be getting married on the stage of the St. James.
This has been such a fascinating thing that's happened. I have noticed, have either of you noticed, I see many more men walking down the street now holding hands than I did before this law was passed. It's so great to see so many people so excited. It's a wonderful thing. May it live forever. And I look for other states to follow in our suit. I know we weren't the first. I'm not saying that, but nevertheless, as the largest state to have it happen, I'm hoping that other large states will take the cue sooner rather than later. The sooner the better.
Yeah, well, I can't address that particular point, Peter, because I live in Hell's Kitchen, so people are always walking holding hands. Gay couple. But but that's great.
You haven't seen more of it, really? You haven't noticed an uptick in that? I certainly have.
Yeah, oh, great. That's wonderful.
It sure is.
Well, on that happy and positive
That's
note,
right.
I think we're going to go out for the day. Peter has you have to go back to work. You have a Sunday 11 a.m. interview. So let's wrap up here and say, on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for spending some time with us on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Running away.
let's do it. Free from the ties that bind. No more despair or burdens to bear out there in the yonder. Running away, go to it. Where did you have in mind? Have to take care, unless there's a where, you'll only be wandering blind. Just more questions, different kind. Where are we to go? Where are we ever to go? Running away, we'll do it. Why sit around resigned? Trouble is some. The farther you run, the more you feel undefined. For what you have left undone, and more, what you've left behind. We disappoint, we leave a mess, we die, but we don't.
We disappoint in turn, I guess, forget though we won't. Like father, like son.